Department of Administration. Peter Anderson, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Secretary of the Administration and the State Treasurer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please report? My name is Peter Anderson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Wisconsin. I'm here appearing on behalf of the defendants, the Wisconsin Department of Administration, the Administration Secretary Mark Viewer, and State Treasurer Jack Boyle. While the defendants in this case are executive branch officials, this case concerns the powers of the two other branches of government. Specifically, this case concerns the authority of the legislature to make statewide resource allocation decisions, including those affecting and going through the judicial branch. At the same time, and principally by reason of the circuit court decision in this case also concerns the authority, scope, and standards of this branch's review of those legislative resource decisions. With respect to the issue of legislative powers, what is being challenged has been is formally a lapse of money from a program revenue account for a former continuing appropriation for court automation. In the defendant's view, what is being challenged, though, is a lapse taken out of context. Any lapse, any legislative lapse of a continuing appropriations revenue account, in general terms, is an attempt to equilibrate historic revenue with prospective spending needs. That's in the general case. There's little that's unusual about it. It's a very fundamental legislative function to determine resource allocation decisions in the first place, and secondly, as to a specific appropriation, to determine whether that appropriation has received more revenues or less revenues than are needed to continue to carry out the desired purpose. That's in the general case. But here, even less was going on, because the challenged lapse was part of not just the total budget package, but specific budget provisions affecting the courts, and even more specifically, specific budget provisions affecting this particular appropriation. Not only did the legislature continue the continuing appropriation for court automation in this same piece of legislation, but it had to, in order to get the level of funding that was necessary, also extend a statutory sunset of the fees that were going to fund this appropriation. In sum, the judicial branch lost $2.9 million as a result of the lapse, and that is what the plaintiffs and the amici concentrate on. But that's not the sum total of what happened, because at the same time, the judicial branch received the appropriation that enabled it to spend over $14 million in that two-year biennium.
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Your Honor.
Welcome, President.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We have, in the law, for instance, a campaign finance checkoff that the legislature created, allowing people to check off the $1, and that goes into the campaign fund. And obviously, at the end of years, it may be depleted completely, and sometimes there's a very big surplus. Let's assume that at the end of a year, at the start of a budget year, there's a surplus in the account, maybe a couple of million dollars. But we all know that a couple of million dollars could be eaten up in two or three big races. Let's say it's a Supreme Court fund. Does the legislature, and now the legislature passes a bill that takes that money and puts it into general purpose revenue, GPR. Is that okay?
My sense, Your Honor, is that it's not okay. My legal intuition is that it's not okay. And but my problem is that for me to say that, then I have to, and I believe this is right, identify what it is that it offends from something broader than just my personal gut feeling. And what I need to look to, unless there's some federal law that prohibits it, is some state constitutional prohibition, which I think might be found.
My intuition is the same as yours, that it's not. But why is that any different from this? Or why is it any different, give you another example, where the legislature, let's say, appropriates $1 out of every driver's license fee for the purposes of highway beautification, of purchasing highway right-of-way. And at the end of 2 years, there's a $3 million in the account because for some reason the Department of Transportation hasn't purchased that land. But clearly there's plenty of land out there to purchase. Can the legislature, at the start of the next biennium, take that $3 million and move it into the general purpose revenue account?
Absent, as to that hypothetical, Your Honor, my intuition is that it may.
Okay, what's
absent,
the difference?
Absent a constitutional constraint, absent a specific constitutional constraint. Now, there are provisions concerning resource funds in the Constitution, which I'm not that familiar with. So there might be something esoteric, you know, just as there are in other states, laws that prevent the use of gasoline taxes for any purpose other than highway. So that might exist. Absent that, the reason I think the key distinction between those two hypotheticals would be the voluntary nature of the campaign check walk. And so there is, in some sense, a promise of a more contractual nature by the state to the taxpayer in that case than there is to the driver's license person. The person getting the driver's license. To the person paying the driver's license fee, the state's promise is if you pay this fee and you pass this test and there's no other legal impairment to your being licensed, you shall be licensed to drive a vehicle in the state of Wisconsin, period. It doesn't go beyond that to, oh, and we're, because this current legislature has decided that $1 will go to highway beautification and $5 will go to building highways, that isn't violent.
But if they've increased it by $1, the driver registration cost, they've increased it by $1, and there's words to the effect that this, well, in fact, there would be words in the legislative history, that this is for the purpose, or this purpose of highway beautification. Right. They could still raid that money.
And that, did you say raid that money?
Raid, yeah.
I
guess it's an
understanding that term is a little bit loaded. I would say yes. I do say yes. The reason is that each legislature, as well as the sitting legislature, has that very plenary authority to determine resource allocation decisions and to change those decisions that were made in a previous legislature.
And just answer to the public court in the next election.
Right, and answerable to the public. In this case, it was what Judge Frankel referred to being merely accountable to the electorate, as our argument is. But being merely accountable to the electorate is what democracy is. Those decisions change from year to year, and from session to session. And even within a session, we see budget. There's a budget bill passed, and then there's the corrected budget bill passed.
Now, is it my understanding that everybody agrees, had the legislature done this differently, followed the bill drafting manual suggested procedure, that this would have been okay?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, one clarification on your question. I don't think there's been any demonstration that the legislature didn't follow the bill drafting manual. But that's a confused issue in this case. And I think that it was confused as well in the trial court's decision.
Right.
Because it seems to be very concerned about these expectations of the public that Justice Babbage was referring to. I paid my driver's license fee and I expect to see, you know, the billboards wiped off the highway. But then couldn't quite go the full 9 yards, which is often, I think, a reflection of error, and say, well, then you can never do it. Instead, just Judge Frankel said, well, you can do it, but you've got to repeal the appropriation. And the plaintiffs go back and forth and back and forth in their brief, and it's very hard to pin them down I can't answer for them, Your Honor, but other than to say that it's apparent to me that they still haven't decided, or at least as to this moment, haven't decided which posture they're taking.
Now, when the client pays this fee into the court, is it so labeled so the litigant knows? I mean, the checkoff on the tax is a choice that the taxpayer makes. You can say the taxpayer knows it because you have to do something affirmatively, but the litigant just pays a flat fee?
I don't think that's in the record. My experience in paying court fees is that you don't get a statement showing where the monies are going to as a matter of appropriation.
So it's a
flat fee, and the right one gets is the right to commence, or in some cases defend, legal proceedings.
Now, I suppose that if you should lose, your side should lose, that what would happen? The court gets the $3 million or whatever amount of money it is?
Well, the legislature will comply, at least to the extent I can represent for the legislature, but I believe I can. Will comply with the judgment of the court.
And then just take it off the next appropriation.
Perhaps. That's certainly part of the... the compliance will be in good faith.
Sure.
But if that is what is opened by the decision, and I think that certainly is what is opened by the decision that's being reviewed by this court, it may be the outcome. Now, the reality, the real outcome is also going to be determined by a political process. You know, can the courts, on the one hand, award themselves $3 million and then the legislature turn around and pull it back? I mean, politically, it may not be feasible to do, but as a matter of raw legislative power, it seems to me Judge Frankel's decision certainly makes that possible. But I think these questions, of course, point to the fact that what's being vindicated in this case, and certainly what's being vindicated by the circuit court's decision, is something very formal. And it seems that if this court, for that matter, of course, the circuit court, is going to invalidate legislation, particularly budget legislation, which is so fundamentally a legislative or democratic process, that something more than a formalism or a formal result be achieved. As I said, the issue, on the one hand, is the issue of legislative power. But the other issue, of course, is this issue of judicial power. And here, I don't think the case has any of the ambiguities that are presented by the plaintiffs flip-flopping on what they're opposing.
Can we stay with the legislative power for just a moment?
Sure, Mr.
Anderson. Going back to my example about the dollar increase in driver's fees, I think in Article 8 or whatever refers to the legislative power to make an appropriation, and we have defined an appropriation. Now, there is some law, is there not, that says when an appropriation is made, subsequent legislatures cannot touch that until, in fact, the need for that, for whatever it was appropriated for, has been exhausted.
I don't think that is a correct statement of the law as to the legislative authority. It has been a general statement of the law as to the executive branch authority. The executive branch can't say, well, we've got enough highway beautification, you know, we don't need to spend that money. Or, you know, highway beautification is important, but wouldn't it be nicer to build some more highways, you know, so let's just transfer money. So I think it's a restriction, the textual, I mean, as a matter of what the language is and the case that we keep citing both sides is the state ex rel Finnegan from the 30s, but it itself is just relying, itself didn't deal with this issue, it was a question of the governor's veto powers, but it relied on these broad statements, general statements of the law as to the constraints on executive authority in administering an appropriation. And we, of course, the executive branch fully recognizes those constraints. But to carry them over to the legislature changes the appropriation process, the constitutional appropriation process, from one in which there are these majorities that come into existence, determine how resources are going to be allocated, and then they may be long gone, and they're still determining how those resources are allocated, and subsequent majorities can't do anything about it. Again, we found in the circuit court the unwillingness to go that far, and it's only because the plaintiffs you know, taking both sides of the position that we even see it in the plaintiff's brief. I will return to legislative powers in my discussion because, of course, they are two sides of the same coin, and they keep recurring. We can analyze this case under separations of powers doctrine, which I think is the more natural way than the way that the circuit court did. But at the moment, I did want to talk about the circuit court's grounds. Because it's one thing for a court to say the legislature has violated the separation of powers. I don't think that should be done very frequently, at least as to these statewide resource allocation decisions. As far as we know, this is the first case where it has been done so directly, where a specific appropriation was struck down. But what the problem, for that, as much as you want to say advocate the sparing use of that doctrinal basis, we have to say we find no basis for the trial court's stated grounds, which was that this lapse violated fundamental principles of public policy. And we could not find any case in which public policy was deemed sufficient grounds to strike down otherwise constitutional legislation. And we could not find any case cited by the plaintiffs in which public policy was invoked for that purpose. The general, and I believe invariant, rule is that legislation is valid unless it violates a specific, unless it violates the federal constitution, the state constitution, or some other federal law, which basically is valid under the supremacy clause. Plainly, public policy can inform constitutional adjudication or the interpretation of federal statutes or regulations, which might be claimed to be preemptive. But it does not displace those sources of law as the guideposts and constraints on legislative action. Moreover, again, going back to the questions of the court suggesting the pluralism of Judge Frankel's decision, as public policy goes, this was a very weak basis for invoking it. For the first ever invocation of public policy to strike down legislation is this idea that once you've told the people it's a continuing appropriation, you've got to stick with that unless you repeal it. I mean, a wholly formal result becomes what became the basis for Judge Frankel striking down this legislation.
It ultimately was repealed. The cumulative appropriation ultimately was appealed. It's now continuing.
I don't know if you call it. I don't know if you call those a repeal or just a new enactment.
It's a change.
Just a change. It went to an annual in the 95. And so exactly what was of concern is, or exactly what the Judge Franklin said, you know, should be done is done. Then just shortly after the suit was filed by the time the next legislature was sitting, so it wasn't even possible for the legislature to pass the law to conform its conduct to what the plaintiff was claiming was necessary.
Just for clarification, when you use the term annual appropriation, what you're saying is in order for there to be an appropriation, each new legislature has to reenact it.
Even a continuing appropriation.
I'm just trying to give you a definitional.
Well, definitionally, an annual appropriation is one whose agency can spend only up to the amount contained in that appropriation and only in that year for which it is appropriated. And to have successive spending, there has to be another annual appropriation. Of course, in a biennium, you have two annual appropriations in the same budget bill. The continuing appropriation is different because the governmental entity, the courts, or the agency would have greater flexibility in deciding when to spend. It doesn't all have to be spent within 1 year versus another year. It's also not a fixed amount, but determined by the monies that come in. There may be an exception to this, but my understanding is that continuing appropriations will be tied to some funding source other than just the direct appropriation. So you say, from the gasoline tax, 2 cents goes to gas vapor.
The 2 cents goes into the general revenue, but there's a debt, quotes, owed back to the particular need, the particular function.
Yeah. In terms, it actually does go to the general fund in most cases, but there are a number of segregated funds. But the fund itself is the, I guess, the thing where the money actually goes, but then the
this
account.
Was not a segregated fund.
This was a general fund program revenue account. Let me turn to the separation of powers issues, if I may, since I see my lights on. Finally, the judiciary has an inherent right to ensure some level of resources necessary to carrying out its core adjudicative functions. I think the reason for this is not simply that the judiciary is this co-equal branch, so it has to have this amount of power. It's the function, it's the very function of what the judiciary does, which is to establish a rule of law as co-equal to the democratic principles that we're trying to advance in this case. That the rule of law is an essential, fundamental part of order democracy. But the exercise of that judicial authority, we submit, should be sparing and should recognize that fundamentally resource decisions, what to tax, how much to tax, what to spend it on, and how much to spend, remains one of the most core democratic rights. As I said, we don't have a case in which a direct resource allocation by the legislature was held constitutionally infirm when it affected the judiciary. Now, there was, of course, the Garden of Light case where there's maybe some county obligations established, but the direct state allocation isn't here. It is difficult to come up with the definitional line to offer this, that definitional line drawing between when the courts can and should not exercise that inherent authority. Resources change. I mean, I would not come here and say it'd be okay to just give every judge some sheets of parchment and quill pens as their the sum and substance of their resources, even though that sufficed, in 1850. But what we submit in this case is that it is not the appropriate instance for the court, either the lower court, which didn't hold on separation of power grounds, or this court, to hold that a legislated allocation of public resources was constitutionally inadequate. We had, over those years in which the appropriation was made and continues to be made, something on the order of $40 million in expenditures on court automation. The challenged legislative action took place 4 years ago and involved, and this is what's difficult to say because it's a lapse considered out of context. Can I say it really involved the judiciary not getting $3 million? Well, it did only if I assume everything else was equal. But to say that this was substantively wrong, I think the plaintiff has to come before this court and say, $40 million wasn't enough. $43 million was the amount the Constitution required. And you can find it in footnote 2 to section 7 of section 1 of the judiciary article. The Constitution is ordinarily not that specific in its determination of what monies go where. And can't be and shouldn't be. What the Constitution is a document that establishes a broad process by which those decisions will be made democratically. This case, I think, rests on this concept of the rule of law. It is necessary to the functioning of the judiciary for its enforcing the rule of law, ensuring the rule of law that it have resources sufficient to that. But paradoxically, or maybe not so paradoxically, the rule of law even says that courts will not strike down legislation absent constitutional infirmity or federal preemption. And the rule of law, I believe, says that the exercise of this court's judicial authority be somewhat sparing.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson. Mr. Gass, you represent Dennis Flynn individually and on behalf of other citizen users of the court system.
I appear here this morning along with attorneys Joseph Good and Susan Philpott on behalf of Judge Dennis Flynn. Let me very quickly do three things, if I could. One is voice the transition and how you set the table this morning. Secondly, respond directly to the two points made by Justice Babich and Chief Justice Abramson, and then get to my introduction. You're to be complimented on how well you set the table. This is now the other shoe. The state in the previous argument acknowledged the judiciary has the right to hire, the judiciary has the right to fire, the judiciary has the right to set the terms of the employment, the hours, and that applies no matter how crucial or uncrucial the employee is. And the state had problems trying to tell you how they would integrate the collective bargaining agreement, the terms of employment, with that authority, which you set on the table. And it's a pretty hollow authority, isn't it? If all you have are the words that you can hire and fire, but you don't have the ultimate money authority. So this, as I said, is the other shoe that now drops, because we've set the table with the Barlin case as to your authority, the judiciary's authority, under inherent powers. And now we have to look at the funding. And Justice Babich, of course, gave us the example of a campaign checkoff. It could have been the stadium tax, and I'd love to hear the Attorney General's explanation for what they can do with the stadium tax if they decide not to build the stadium when it's a program revenue. And he agreed that his sense was the same as everybody's in this room, that it would be wrong to take the stadium tax and use it for something else, just as it would be wrong to take the campaign checkoff and use it for something else. But yeah. He said he couldn't find that it was unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional.
Can't the legislature change the campaign finance law even after the checkoff?
They can change the tax, or they can change the checkoff. But what they can't change is the appropriation and the application of the funds. Program revenue is program revenue is program revenue. It is there. You can't sunset it. You can sunset the tax, but you can't sunset the funds. And so the unconstitutional ground is found in Section 5 and Section 3 of Article 8. The legislature has the right to tax to fund the expenses and the appropriations set in two. Excuse me.
And is that what Judge Frankel said?
Well, in a roundabout way.
Yes, that's what I answered.
I guess I know where I'm not going to try. He gave voice to the interplay of those two statutes, and he used what I take is a shorthand fashion of doing it, of saying that this is public policy. And that's the way I voice it. The public policy that he gave voice to so eloquently is what's found between the taxing power in sub 5 and the appropriation, the requirement that you spend for what you've appropriated for in sub 2. That's where his public policy comes from. It's the common sense, it's the common conscience, it what makes even the Attorney General say it's his sense that it wouldn't be okay. Now, the
how many of these things do you think we've got? If your position is it covers campaign financing and it covers the stadium tax, how many of these special put in the word special, fees and assessments are there that will then be tied up in this manner?
Can't tell you. I apologize.
A lot, a little, three, ten?
Well, it's the trend.
That's why I asked the question.
I mean,
it strikes me as that there are a lot.
Yeah, the one that is now being floated, if you excuse the pun, by the Department of Natural Resources, is a fee for kayaks and canoes. Program revenue, yeah.
Well, and the sesquicentennial with the sale of the license plates, and it raised more money than was expected, and I think the legislature, if they haven't already done it, is considering moving the funds from the sesquicentennial to something else. When I say moving the funds, instead of allocating it, putting it somewhere else.
And I think you breach the covenant with the taxpayers when you put a tax for a program revenue, and then it doesn't get used for that. That is...
Specifically violate Section 5 and Section 2 of Article 8, because as I see it, that really is the only constitutional underpin. I don't want to give away the rest of the case, but I'd have to be greatly convinced of the shared powers argument, et cetera. But Article 8, Section 5 and Section 2 seem
right.
to have...
That's where it's based.
Okay, and how? What does Section 5 say that you think affects Section 2, which then is affected by how we've defined appropriation or whatever?
5 says you can only tax to cover the expenses, and 2 says you can only pay according to an appropriation by law. So on the one hand, you can tax, but you are taxing to pay the appropriations. And the appropriations in 2 are those by law. And so if you tax for something that you say is going to be an expense, i.e. CCAP in this situation, but you don't pay for that appropriation that was set by law, you have violated those 2 constitutional provisions.
What if there is no longer any need for the money in the program revenue appropriation? If you know, we bought all the equipment we needed and we still had $3 million left.
Yeah.
And we just continue the CCAP program.
That is the one spot where I have problems. Because I can argue to you that program revenue can never change its spots. And I can argue to you that program revenue has to always be continuing. I don't think they could have change it to an annual appropriation as they did. Because program revenue inherently has to stay continuing. But if the program then stops, if there is nothing more that can be bought, then I can't argue to you that it has to remain there. But at that point, we would then go to the statute that says program revenue or continuing revenue remains until depleted or repealed by the legislature.
Can you tell me what your authority, or other than your theory on the Constitution, what your legal authority is for the analysis you just gave us?
First time we've been confronted with it.
So.
And despite the wonders of Judge Frankel's computer and what he found, I can't give you any more than he did.
You agree that although Judge Frankel clearly said he wasn't meeting the constitutional analysis and didn't discuss the... presumption of constitutionality, if we adapt, we go into your analysis that we have to begin with the presumption of constitutionality and you have to convince the court that it's unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt.
I don't agree that I have to give it a presumption of constitutionality, and the authority is best stated by Judge Frankel in footnote 10 on page 18 of the decision. I think he's right on point. We don't have to give that presumption in a budgetary process like this. There's an exception for that. And if you accept the legal actions argument, this was a special law that was not individually titled and not individually submitted and not on a single subject. So I don't think you have to give it that presumption. But I hope you're not bothered by the fact that I can't give you 3 or 4 cases on unconstitutionality. There are times in the development of the law, whether it's the common law and it's Wabi versus Warrington and there's an expression of case law, or whether it is the first time that you look at this particular problem, I think that's just what you're confronted with here. Now, the next question. Mr. Anderson had this morning from Chief Justice Abramson was, well, could it have been made okay if the rules manual had been followed? And I don't think they could have ever made this okay.
Well, that's, you just said that under Chapter 20, there was a provision. This was an answer to Justice Babbage. What happens if the program is gone? That you indicated there was a way of repealing this so that you could use that money.
Right.
So I interpreted that argument that I read in your brief to mean they had to do it in that lockstep manner, and had the legislature done it, then they could have taken the $3 million. But they did not.
Right. Right.
So there was a way then they could have done it. If I understood your argument.
Specific bill saying funds are no longer needed for CCAMP. They have fully computerized the court system. There remains $10.73. It's hereby repealed and goes into general program.
So your answer to Justice Babbage was they can take that money.
If they do it right.
If they do it right.
Right.
And they didn't do it right here.
They didn't do it right.
What steps didn't they follow? They didn't say that exactly. They merely said, we're taking it.
Right. So a separately titled, single subject bill.
Why?
Would have allowed the media, would have allowed the public, would have allowed it to be debated as to whether it's appropriate or not.
There's nothing in the Constitution that requires that. You know, I know that the cases on the local legislation issue and special legislation talk about one of the goals, but there's nothing in the Constitution that requires that. This whole budget bill is filled with stuff.
Well,
that doesn't fit any of that.
And it perhaps fits with your comment that, well, if we put it back in, maybe they'll just take it off the next appropriation.
Right. Why can't they do that?
Well,
it's not taking it off the next appropriation. They're going to appropriate $10 million to CCAP. They'll now appropriate $7 million, figuring you already got $3 million.
Right. And that's why, as much as I agree with Judge Frankel's decision, as much as I believe that this was unconstitutional and not in comport with the statutes, I think at the end of the day, that is not the way to decide this case.
Okay.
Because you're going to be confronted then with similar problems just as you have for 100 years. You can start with in-rate janitor, you can go to air conditioning, you can go to computerized research. And if you want to, we'll all come back in 2 or 3 years, and instead of being CCAP and Judge Barlin deciding on a secretary or not, it'll just be something else.
So what do you suggest?
Well, I think you have the authority to say that the judiciary really is a separate and co-equal branch of the government. And that this is not really...
I'm willing to say that.
We've said that.
Yeah.
Now what do you say? What's your second line?
Well, I was going to say I was tempted to quote from your submission to the APA and your submission...
I'm right with you. You got me 100%. Right. Now what's your second line?
It's time to say that the judiciary has to have some sufficient funding, period. End of story. It's not just a turf battle. It's not a, this is our authority. It is the only way that the judiciary can function going into the next election.
Why don't you tell me how you think some sufficient works, Mr. Gaddis?
Well, my understanding is that you get, you have in the existing budgeting system, you have some sufficient, you have some certain, my understanding of some sufficient would be you make the decision as to what you need to run this judiciary for the next year. And if it's $10 million, that's the figure that's sent to the legislature, either directly or through the governor's office, not doing away with cooperation, not doing away with comedy or anything else, but telling them what you need. And at the end of the year, that's the bill that has to be paid.
No questions asked. No questions asked. Just create whatever positions we want to create. under the 10 million.
Absolutely. And the constitutional provision for it is the unique one that not even the U.S. Constitution has for the U.S. court system.
Mr. Gass, that's not exactly how sum sufficient works. It gives us a little more flexibility than sum certain. We can't, at least under the present statutes, which you might think we should declare unconstitutional, we don't provide for positions without legislative authority in the court structure, even with a sum sufficient.
Well,
you think we ought to do away with that?
Yes, I think that if the Constitution means what it says, that this court has superintending and administrative control of the judiciary.
And what about Article 8 that says the legislature taxes and spends?
The legislature has to tax as sufficient to pay for what it takes to run the courts.
Doesn't that in effect give us appropriation power, which is reserved exclusively to the legislature?
Well,
I mean, it may not say it, your words may not say it, but that's the end effect. Because anything that we send over to them, they must appropriate, is what you're saying.
Right, I am saying that. Because it is an expense of the government. It is just like the expense of the governor's office. It is just like an expense of the legislature.
But the
this
governor,
branch is no different.
Can't appropriate money. He's got to go to the legislature.
How do we?
We know how it works.
I think we know how it works. How do you enforce that, though? So we've done what you have asked, and now we have the enforcement.
Well, you confronted it in Moran. You decided not to, so to speak, force the issue, but you acknowledged you have the right to not only implement, but carry out the budget.
Then if we do that, we ought to, in your second sentence, we have the total power to set the budget and demand that you appropriate this money, but we're not going to do it because we're friendly.
Well,
that's what we did in Moran.
Right.
Then are you suggesting we do that here?
I am
so
not.
All of that, and then we say, but we're not going to take the $3 million.
No, because at the time of Moran, you took the broad look at the entire state of the Wisconsin economy, and you said there is a financial inability here to do this. But at this point in time, we don't have that financial inability. At the time we argued this case, or at the time that this $3 million was either raided or taken or whatever from this program, the State of the State address that year, Governor Thompson touted the surplus that was in the state.
I know. And the result also is that there are a lot of demands on that surplus.
Right.
Which the legislature is going to have to give priorities to, right? And you're saying that we should give priority to ourselves first.
No. By stating once and for all that the judiciary in this state is funded on a sum sufficient basis doesn't mean we have to have a Saturday night crisis. You can do everything that you're doing now. You can do the cooperation, you can do the ride-along, you can do the committee that from the legislature.
It'll be a shoot-along, Mr. Gass.
The what?
It'll be a shoot-along.
I think part of comedy is plain-spokenness and candor and saying what is more than just the words that have been said under inherent and separation of power.
Suppose we do that. You think that the people of the state can amend this Constitution and say that we have judicial power and the judiciary, superintending power, but, and add in a clause, that the judiciary is subject to the same rules as the other branches of government and the agencies whereby the legislature taxes and determines its appropriations?
The way my short answer is yes.
Okay.
And the way I would say it is this. I would not be afraid to say that the judiciary has some sufficient financing and that it's good for the democracy because there are adequate checks and balances within our structure in the state of Wisconsin. You put your finger on one, that the Constitution could be amended. There's recall. There's not electing. Some of you have been through very difficult election campaigns, and you know that there are hotly contested judicial elections where scrutiny can be put on anything and everything you did, whether it's decisions or whether it's budgeting. There's government hearings. There are sophisticated politicians in the governor's office, in the legislature, who can bring the spotlight to bear on if you're budgeting for ermine robes for everybody. So,
what's the matter with that?
So my point is, while it may initially sound drastic for you to enunciate once and for all that the power of the Constitution that says that you have administrative and superintending authority includes the power to set a sum sufficient budget, is not as shocking, because it has adequate safeguards within the system, especially within Wisconsin.
That declaration isn't critical to you prevailing here, though, is it? We don't have to find that that constitutionally we're entitled to some sufficient across the board in order for you to prevail on your argument.
No.
I'd like to draw you back into that.
Yeah. And no, I'm pleased, though, that that's where we got, because the briefs set out the law and the analysis and all that, but I think it's more important that you confront the question that you're confronting today in Barlin and in the Flynn case.
Mr. Gass, let's assume that your side were to win in this case. Why should we take the approach of common fund in regard to attorney's fees?
Well, I think employees' trust is pretty close to on point. But if you really push me on that analysis, the numbers of people involved are larger than an employee's trust, because it's everybody who's been a litigant who's paid a CCAP fee. And I know that you kind of have to take a second step. But think about this for the moment. If you don't award fees, and whether they're on an hourly basis or a lodestar, I mean, that's your business. If you don't, who's ever going to bring one of these cases? Who has the manpower and the womanpower to devote to this kind of case? I'm in over $100,000 in time and expenses on this case, trying to put in front of you every argument that we can think of. And there's no way that anybody's going to take it on unless there is some reward besides just feeling good at the end of it.
Is there any distinction between the legislature taxing for general purposes all of the public who are eligible to be taxed, and this, which is really a special fund accumulated through special users of government? Do they have less power over the special fund that was accumulated only by users of the system,
yes,
not from the general,
yes,
taxpaying public?
Yes, right. They have less power because they called it a program revenue. They constrained themselves. They had the choice going in. They didn't have to make this a CCAP tax. They could have made this just an increased filing fee and treated it as general revenue. But once you create that covenant with the taxpayer or with the litigant in this case, and you say, I'm imposing this special fee for this program, I think then under 5 and 2, you have to constitutionally apply those funds that way, and you can't move them over.
Haven't they, this isn't like they have the trout stamp fund, which you have for building up stream banks. That's specific, but the highway fund, for example, haven't they transferred funds from the highway fund into other entities? There hasn't been that is taken as something that they have the power to do.
Right. There's shades of gray. It's very easy when we talk about the stadium tax or CCAP, and it's very difficult then when we get towards the general revenue, where it's the tax that you just referred to. And if you make the decision that I'm asking you to make, and you make it on statutory grounds, the legislature is just going to, quote, wise up.
But if the state prevails in this argument, would, for instance, the trout tax fund be vulnerable?
Every single one of them would be. It's not just the shades of gray. It's the black and the whites at both ends. And now I can see we're really getting down to something that is.
That goes into the general revenue, is not a segregated fund?
Say again, I'm sorry.
The tax goes into the general revenue and it's not a segregated fund.
I don't think that it makes any difference whether they put it in a money market account at the security bank and call it the Trout Stream Fund, whether they put it there or whether they commingle the funds in the big vault, wherever that is. They have made the contract with the taxpayer, with the user. We're taxing you for trout, or we're taxing you for a stadium, or we're taxing you for CCAP. So it doesn't make any difference where they put it in the vault.
Counselor, an argument is made that Judge Frankel's decision is based on substituting his vision of what is good public policy versus what the legislature has determined is good public policy. What legal authority do you have to support a proposition that a statute can be deemed invalid by the court based on a vision of public policy?
Well, that's where he got out a little in front of me. See, when I say he gave voice to the interplay between 5 and 2 in Article 8, when he brought Finnegan and Gissel and the Hickel case, and he brought that all together and he brought it under the ambit of public policy, he's got an anchoring in the Constitution, or I have, by kind of rephrasing it. To take him the next step to where he verbalized that you can take this amorphous public policy concept and apply it at any time to a piece of legislation, I acknowledge I've got problems. I think he's right. It's the same thing as earlier. I have a sense that he's right. But this is kind of the seminal case where you have the opportunity to say that is correct constitutional analysis, that you can look at a statute and you can make a determination as to whether it is at variance with, as in Merton, common sense, common conscience, those types of concepts.
Now, had the legislature not created this as programmed revenue, but had simply increased the filing fee and put that into the general fund, and then in a separate part of the budget, in the court's budget, allowed $14 million or whatever it was for CCAP, then there would have been no problem. I think you would agree. There would have been no problem if they'd have simply taken money, taken that to whatever excess was, and spent it elsewhere.
There is no statutory problem. There is no constitutional problem.
Well, isn't
that's why I say you now come to the separation of powers, the inherent powers side of the argument.
But
that is how you're going to be played forever.
Well, see, but the program revenue, listing this as program revenue, you know, all I remember is how it used to come through and there'd be a list of source of funds and GPR and program revenue and all that. That's largely semantic, isn't it? Aren't you asking us to make a semantic distinction?
Well,
rather than substantive?
No, I don't think you can call it semantics.
But you want us to say that any time there's a program revenue fund established, that that's essentially untouchable unless and until the legislature says there's no more need for it.
Absolutely. Because I don't think you can go into a bar in Stevens Point or Minocqua or wherever and say you're getting taxed $3 for X and expect the person sitting next to you on the bar stool to not throw their arms up if it isn't used for that. I think it's that fundamental. You can't tax without spending it on what you say you're going to tax for.
So suppose the legislature doesn't say it, but has a user fee, just ups the user fee for state parks, and doesn't necessarily say I'm going to use it for the state park. Now, if I go there and I see a tax on my use of the park, I assume that they're going to use that for the parks. Is that a contract with me?
Well, that, I have to acknowledge to you, that's where it gets into the grayer area.
And counsel, you got all these court fees and they don't go to the courts necessarily. They go into the general pot. The court may pull out more than it put in, or the court may pull out less than it pulled in.
That's why at the end of the day, I say, and my red light is on, and so I'll conclude on it. Why have us back here 2 years from now or 3 years from now with just another shade of gray?
That's why you want us to use our inherent power and declare we're a separate and independent branch of government, and we'll declare how much money we need.
You get there one of three ways, one of two ways, really. Inherent power or the very specific constitutional provision that you have, superintending and administrative authority. Either way, you get there.
I don't know if it's Jefferson or Madison or whatever, but in response to your Marshall opinion, he said, well, Marshall has given us his opinion, now let him enforce it. You're prepared for that kind of a confrontation?
I'm always willing to take on that case. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. We try to advise our clients not to all that Jeffersonian response. There's been much talk here. First of all, let me say there's been much talk about Article 8, Sections 2 and Sections 5 as the source of, at least the textual source of this still somewhat nebulous. I point out to the court that there's no citation to Section 5 in the red brief. I don't think it's in mine either, but it's certainly not the plaintiff's brief, which, by the way, textually requires that there be enough money, to be taxed to cover the bills. You know, it's just an anti-debt provision. We can't have, like, state debts as we can at the federal level. Section 2, of course, is one that requires appropriation to be made by law, which the suggestion that this court take over its own appropriation function, I think, would be in the very difficult to reconcile. Appropriations by law has always meant by the legislature, subject to the governor's veto, publication requirements, yea and nay vote requirements, quorum requirements. It is not for this court to determine its own appropriations, except in those very rare cases. And not one has yet come, I think, before this court on a statewide level, where the resources really prevent the court from carrying out its rule of law function. There's much talk about what it is for this court to be, or the judiciary, to be a co-equal branch. In some ways, this is the most vulnerable of branches. It doesn't get to tax and spend. And yet, in some ways, it's the most important branch, because it determines the law. And the executive and the legislature will comply with the laws determined by this branch. Regardless of the size of your monitors. And that is a very, very important role for this, that the core function of this branch, this court. We think Judge Frankel deviated from that role by discerning from non-constitutional principles, but a sense of public policy, further constraint or a further authority to invalidate legislation. And a further authority to invalidate legislation without real good reason for doing it. Much of the discussion with opposing counsel, I think by this court, has kept pointing to what really are semantic distinctions or formalisms as the plaintiff's approach. And it is really not much different, as I hear it, from what we read in the briefs. You know, at the 1 minute, you just got to repeal it. You know, it's okay to... It's okay to take this money away, but you have to do it by such and such magic words. You know, and then at another point, we're asking this court to take, you know, the unheard of step of determining its appropriation. It's not in the rare instance where it's necessary to ensure its functioning, but in all instances.
Mr. Anderson, what's wrong with the argument that an appropriation under Section 2 from program revenue is a contract with the people that... It's a promise that can't be broken.
It's, I mean,
except when the need is no longer demonstrable.
Your Honor, I think the answer is that the contract with the people and with the taxpayers is the Constitution, which says these resource allocation decisions are going to be determined democratically, and you are going to have the right to vote in every election, and you, if you're in the majority, get to decide how those resources are going to be used, and when you're out of the majority, you're not going to be able to decide, and someone else is going to decide, and you're going to have to live with it. And when you're in public service, it doesn't matter what you are, at least in the executive branch, you always hear people say, I'm a taxpayer. You know, so that means they can decide how you're going to do things. No, it's the legislature. That gave them the right to vote for the legislature, and the legislature will tell us how we do things. But that's a system of democracy. As important as this court's role is that role. The two go hand in hand. There are occasions, as in Mr. Rice's case, where the distinction gets blurred. This is not that case, Your Honor.
Is there a doctrine in this state, and I remember it, I think, at the federal level, that one legislature can't bind the other?
I believe that is doctrinal. We've stated it in our brief.
So
it is a concept of majority rights. They can, of course, by constitutional amendment. You know, then, of course, it's binding in perpetuity until another amendment changes. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Gass. We are at recess until 1:45.